Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you, like the rest of America, are looking to move down here to the Tampa Bay area in Florida and you want to work with a realtor who knows the area well, then make sure you reach out to Ann at West Florida Real Estate. Ann has sold over 350 homes here in the Bay Area over the last 6 years. She's smart, she's lived in the area for 16 years, and you won't find anyone around with a better work ethic. Reach out to her at Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com and let her know you heard about her here on Everyone Loves Guitar. That's Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. For information on advertising, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. And if you're enjoying the show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. We got an awesome guest with us today with Russell Ferrante. Excellent keyboard player. He's got a new album out. It's charging up the charts. It's called Inflection. We'll talk about that. We got a lot to go over here. Russell, of course, co-founder of the Yellow Jackets, along with Robin Ford, Jimmy Haslip, and Ricky Lawson. A couple of quick announcements. I want to thank Jimmy Haslip, one of the nicest human beings I've ever met in my life. Jimmy, awesome. Guy's like a saint connecting us. Also, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe button, that little emoji. It looks like a bell that helps us get recommended by YouTube. And I appreciate your support in doing that. Quickly on Russell's background, began studying piano at the age of 9. This guy is a lovely guy too. We had a lot of time to talk. You're going to love this interview. His early musical experiences revolved around the church where his dad was the choir director. His interest in jazz and improvisation was kindled in high school, and shortly thereafter he began performing with various R&B and jazz groups in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today, Russell continues his 40-year association with the Yellow Jackets, performing and conducting clinics worldwide. Did you give yourself like a gold watch for that?
Gold watch.
For 40 years. From the band's inception in 1980, they have recorded over 20 albums, receiving 15 Grammy nominations and winning 2 awards for Best R&B Instrumental Performance in 86 and Best Contemporary Jazz Performance in 89. They also wrote and performed music for Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. Over the last 45 years, Russell's also recorded or performed with Lorraine Feather, Art Blakey, look at these names, John Klemmer, Lee Ritenour, Larry Carlton, Kevin Lateau, Brenda Russell, Randy Crawford, Eric Marienthal, Wayne Shorter, Joe Farrell, Bobby McFerrin, Tom Scott, Robin Ford, of course, George Michael, Marilyn Scott, Julia Fordham, Marcus Miller, Take Six, Michael Franks, Joni Mitchell, Sadao Watanabe, the GRP All-Star Big Band, Art Pepper, Ernie Watts, Dave Grusin, Jim Pepper, Mindy Hebert, Al Jarreau, Mimi Fox, Jimmy Haslip, of course, and others. Russell's new album out with his trio is called Inflection. It's 11 songs, it's over an hour and 12 minutes, and it's packed with 7 really well-written jazz instrumentals that groove. They feel great to listen to. And a quick note, I just want to let you know, if you're interested, Robin Ford, Mindy Hebert, Mimi Fox, and Jimmy Haslip were all on the show if you want to check out their previous shows. Thank you so much for your time, man. I appreciate you coming to the show, Russell.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
I had such a good time talking to you before. I feel like we need a cocktail now or something.
Yeah, show's over. We're
done. Hey, in 1973, you met Robin Ford, and then you wound up touring the States and Europe with Robin as part of Jimmy Witherspoon's band. Curious, how did you initially meet Robin, and how did you wind up working with Jimmy?
Yeah. Well, I had in high school and then in college, I was bagging groceries at a local supermarket. And this guy came in the back door where employees entered, wailing on a harmonica. And he was selling women's shoes, and we became friends. And he told me, man, there's this great guitarist playing at this pizza parlor downtown in San Jose. That's where I was born and was working, and we should go check him out. And so that was my first introduction to Robin. He was playing, this is probably like 1971 maybe, and he had a group with his brother on drums and a couple other guys from Ukiah, California, which is north of San Francisco. And Robin would spend part of the time playing guitar, like Little Walter tunes and traditional Chicago blues. And then he would pick up a saxophone and play Coltrane and Archie Shepp tunes.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd never seen a musician like that. And I was just getting introduced to jazz. And I was, you know, completely taken with Robin's playing. And so I saw him many times after that. And he came to see me at a little gig in Half Moon Bay, California. And his pianist had just left his band, and he asked me if I would be interested in joining their group. And so I ended up doing that and rehearsing at Robin's house for a few weeks. We learned his music. And the first tour we did, we flew out to the East Coast, and we did a double bill with War at this
holy crap. Where?
It was in Norfolk, Virginia, at a huge arena. And Jimmy Witherspoon, who Robin was playing with, and we became Spoon's band. He was opening for War. And then the next gig we played at Shea Stadium, opening at the Cool Jazz Festival. And
wow. Second gig you're playing at
Shea Stadium? That was my second gig at Shea Stadium. I'd never even been on an airplane before.
Oh, my God. That's so cool.
Yeah. And then we flew to Europe and played for 5 weeks, opening for Eric Burdon, who had a group. Do you remember
Eric? Yeah, of course. Eric Burdon and the Animals. Yeah, and he was with War.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
So the management company Robin was in and with, and also Jimmy Witherspoon was with, represented those two groups as well. So anyway, that was my initiation into sort of the world of professional music.
That's so cool. How old were you at the time?
I think I was 21, yeah.
Your parents were behind your music career?
They were supportive, yes. They weren't too happy that I had dropped out of college like the year before. And I was still living at home at that time and was feeling a bit of guilt about that out of school and at home. So we struck a deal. I bought them a television set and painted their house. And that kind of, I felt like, well, I'm contributing to the household.
That was really nice of you. That's really,
I just felt,
where did you get that sense of responsibility from? That's pretty heavy for a young kid.
Yeah. I mean, I think from my parents, and both my mom and dad were, you know, children of the Depression era. They were really hardworking people. And I think my sister and I both really got a lot. I mean, we learned those lessons from the example of my parents, you know, hard work and really.
That's wonderful, man. Yeah. What did your dad do? What kind of work did he do?
My dad, when I was young, he drove a bread truck for a company.
That's a great job, by the way. Anybody who doesn't, that's a very good job.
Yeah.
You made good money there for someone that didn't pursue higher education.
Yeah, I mean, with a gig like that.
Bread route, yeah.
Yeah, could afford a home at that point. And then he eventually ended up moving from there. A friend got him a job at a leasing agency, and then he eventually opened his own leasing company, and he was really successful.
That's awesome.
And my dad always said, you know, as a salesperson, you're selling yourself more than you're selling your product. I mean,
he's right.
People have to like you and trust you, and he was likable and trustworthy and really a sharp business person.
That's great, man. What a nice story. That's so cool.
Yeah.
I can't believe you played Shea Stadium your second gig.
Yeah, holy. I can't.
But, you know what? But like, it's kind of sad that that doesn't happen. And just like you opened for War. What a great, like, yeah. You know, I'd love to see you guys opening for War, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that doesn't exist anymore, man. It's so sad.
Yeah. We hung a lot in Los Angeles with those guys because we shared the same rehearsal space. So the keyboard player Lonnie, his Rhodes and stuff was set up there, and we would often, you know, they'd rehearse and then we'd come in after them and we'd talk about piano stuff. He would play for me a little bit, ask me a question or two.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
Who is their guitar player? I forgot his name. He's a great player.
I don't remember. It's been.
Yeah. I can't. I actually reached out to him a couple of years ago because I couldn't get a hold of him because I was in the gym one day and you know, on my iPhone, War came up and I'm like, shit, I love this. And I said, let me see if I could get a hold. And I just couldn't get a hold of the guy. I can't think of his name, but great, great guitarist, man. Great guitarist.
Yeah.
What early on that first tour, what were some important lessons you learned that you kind of stayed with you? It could be musically, business, performance, you know, whatever was important to you back then.
Wow. Well, you know, I think honestly on that first tour, I was just so blown away by everything. I mean, I was kind of in awe and pinching myself the whole time. I mean, like I mentioned, I'd never been on an airplane. I'd never been on the road with a roommate. And so I guess, I'd never been to New York City, you know. So
what was that like?
That was so unbelievable. I mean, I know you grew up in Bronx, right?
Yeah.
All right. So for me, going to New York was like kind of making a pilgrimage to Mecca as someone interested in jazz music.
Yeah.
And we had a couple days off there and I tried to see as much music as I could.
Did you go to like the Village Gate or something like that while you were there?
Yeah, I went to a bunch of different
venues.
Yeah, and some lofts and saw, you know, just some crazy guys playing free jazz. I saw the Heath brothers in some part of town. I think it was, I don't know that I should have been walking on the streets actually like I was in this area, but anyway, it was really amazing. And yeah, and then to go to Paris and London and, you know, it was just a mind expanding experience. When I came home, I just felt like, you know, my DNA had been rearranged. I'd really
that's so cool.
Experienced this thing that, you know, I couldn't have imagined.
That's great, man.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, how cool is it listening to Jimmy Witherspoon sing Ain't Nobody's Business? Because like that's such a great song. And he's such another, you don't have guys like him anymore performing.
That's, He was, that was his signature piece. And he could tell that story. And there was another tune that it was a newer tune for him that he would always sing as well, called Past 40 Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And in this blues, you know, he would allude to the fact that, you know, maybe his libido wasn't quite as strong as it had been when he was a young man. But he always said at the end of the song, only a story, ladies and gentlemen.
That's great. Past 40 Blues. That's funny. In 75, you moved to L.A., and then shortly after that, you and Robin and Jimmy founded the Yellow Jackets. What prompted you to go to L.A., and what was the scene there like at the time, and how did that all come together?
Yeah, that was a real pivotal time. So I'll back up just a little bit.
Yes,
so
please,
after having played with Robin and gone on tour, I moved up to San Francisco, actually in 1975. And I had kept in touch with Robin, and we still played a few gigs. And actually, I went on the road with Jimmy Witherspoon without Robin. He had left the band, but we had another group. And that's a whole nother story. We drove cross-country from Los Angeles to New York to play at the Half Note. We were a day late.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was during the gas shortage.
In the 70s, yeah. Wednesday, yeah, it was like your last name or something, right?
Yeah,
like,
it was it was incredible.
I remember that.
Cars breaking down. And anyway, but...
That's wild.
So I kept in touch with Rob, and he got a recording contract and was going to put together a band, and he invited me to come and play in his group. So in 1977, I moved to Los Angeles and started working with Robin and some other, you know, through Robin, I met a lot of different people. He was really pivotal to my becoming a professional musician and having the opportunities I've had.
How did you, I know you've been asked this 100 times. It's the only question I hope to ask you. How did the band come together? The three of you guys?
Yes. So we started as Robin's group. So when I moved to Los Angeles, Robin had met Jimmy Haslip and Ricky Lawson, who were at that time playing with the Brazilian vocalist Flora Pura.
Yeah, Purina, sure.
And,
yeah.
And Ayrto.
Ayrto, yeah.
Yeah. So through Robin, Robin put the four of us together.
Okay.
And then to make a longer, I'll try to make it short, but Robin also had an interest in, you know, singing and doing more blues and pop oriented music. So we formed essentially a band within a band just to play the instrumental stuff. And Robin's manager got the tape to someone at Warner Brothers, and the producer Tommy LaPuma heard the tape, and he was excited by the music on it, and he signed us to Warner. So Robin had a deal with Elektra Asylum and the Yellow Jackets as a band signed to Warner's. Actually, without Robin, but Robin was, you know, he had put it all together. And Robin stayed for a record and a half, and then he continued on with his solo career, but we kept Yellow Jackets going.
Jimmy mentioned Tommy LaPuma quite a lot. Was he a big help for you guys, if I remember correctly, right?
Yes, he was. He was an incredible guy. He signed us, and he produced the first, I think, maybe two or three recordings. And through him we were introduced to, you know, great studios and engineers. And on the first record in particular, he made all the choices about the musicians aside from the band who performed the Sea Wind horns, you know, Jerry Hay and Larry Williams, all of those guys. Great. Paulinho da Costa, great percussionist.
Yeah.
Lenny Castro. So Tommy kind of took us under his wing and helped us get started.
That's great. Yeah. Mm-hmm. One more question about Jimmy Witherspoon. I watched some recordings of him. His guitar player, let's say in the 80s maybe. Do you happen to know who that was?
I'm not sure. I know for a time, like when Robin left, the guitarist was someone named, his nickname was Hollywood Fats.
I know.
Was Michael Mann.
Okay, that guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and he played with Spoon for a while, but I'm not sure who did after that.
Yeah, it was a black guy, and I watched some videos. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, it was just...
Wow, I need to check him out. It
was phenomenal. I was just curious. I want to listen to him more. It was phenomenal.
Yeah.
All righty. What were... early on, as far as getting the Yellow Jackets launched and like defining your own sound and figuring out who we want to be, what were some of your challenges as far as that goes?
Wow. You know, I think we pretty much just followed our own musical instincts. I think we were kind of clueless about commerciality or what would get played on the radio. We've been really fortunate to just kind of play the music we were interested in and excited by. And we had the support of a record company, you know, like Warner Brothers in the beginning, which was incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
And we had a manager and we had a booking agent, and we, none of us were really making any money because we were paying everything to all these people. But we didn't care. We were making records and getting to travel and play. So that the focus, I mean, maybe it sounds naive, but it's always been on the music. That's
yeah. No, it doesn't sound naive at all, especially when you're 20. What are you going to do? Think about contributing to your IRA? I mean,
yeah, no, none of that.
That's not happening.
None of us were married. I don't know at that time, or maybe I had just gotten married in 1980. That's when the Jackets
married.
I'm still married. Yeah. Are
you serious? Congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. So it's like 40 years. Hey man, that's awesome. Congratulations.
41 this year. Yeah.
Dude, congratulations to you both. That's really cool. Great to hear that, man. That's nice.
Yeah.
Alrighty. All right. I'm going to talk about some artists you've played with, and if you could tell me how you connected with them and maybe a cool or interesting story about working with them. Let's start with the famous Art Blakey.
Wow. Yeah, that came through a bassist I was working with in San Francisco named Chris Amberger. And Chris was playing with Art Blakey at the time, and there was going to be a weekend gig in Phoenix. And I don't know what the situation was with Art's regular pianist, but he couldn't make the gig. So Chris recommended me for the job. And we traveled out to Arizona, and it was I think it was some like kind of jazz party. They used to have these events in Arizona at a hotel, and I remember there was a bandstand around a swimming pool and a bunch of people hanging out, and we played for 2 days. The music was fairly straightforward. I don't even remember if I rehearsed before the first gig.
I was going to ask you that. That must have been a lot of tunes to learn. And then, I mean, that's...
Yeah, it was kind of, you know...
had to be hard, no?
Yeah, it wasn't that hard, no. It was, I mean, the music was pretty clear. It was fairly straightforward. I mean, I was familiar with his music.
Okay.
Or the style, certainly. And Art was really cool and very supportive, and I played the gig, and that was it. I don't know if his regular pianist came back or whatever happened, but it was a fun like weekend gig and an opportunity to check him out, one of the legends out at you know, in close proximity.
Wow. Okay, let me skip that. Wayne Shorter, who started with Art, obviously played with Miles, and then started Weather Report. How did that come about?
Yeah, that I think came through a recommendation from the drummer Tom Breckline.
Okay.
And Tom was playing with Wayne's band along with bassist Gary Willis, and they recommended me, and... It was for a gig in Brazil. And so prior to the gig, Wayne's music is really hard. I mean, unlike Art's, which was fairly straightforward, Wayne Shorter's music was so specific. And it's almost like reading a concerto music or something. Everything he writes out, all the voicings, I had to double certain bass lines. And it was very technically challenging. So... for 2 weeks prior to the gig, I went every 5 days a week to Wayne's house, and we rehearsed. And that was, I think it was like going to music school for a year.
Wow.
In those 2 weeks, just learning his music and hearing what he had to say and his direction, what he was looking for. And my favorite, one of the more memorable moments during these rehearsals, I was playing on a tune, soloing on it, and Wayne kind of looked over the keyboard and he said to me, "Play the notes next to the notes you want to play." And I mean, it was like, what? But I later realized, you know, what he was after was, you know, don't play what's comfortable, what's right under your fingers. Don't play what you've been practicing. Reach for, you know, the unknown, you know. Don't play the known. Reach beyond that. And I think that must have been a lesson he learned from Miles Davis as well, because
yeah,
I've read that was Miles' advice to a lot of the musicians. He would try to put kind of make them uncomfortable a little bit.
Yeah. You
know? Get them out of their comfort zone so they could find something new and stretch. So play the notes next to the notes. And I think of that often.
That's such a good and I agree with you. I think that's how that's how you grow in anything you're doing, is absolutely. Like getting uncomfortable, you know, doing
that's
this
right.
Doing the same thing is nice, but there's no growth in that, you know, for sure. Yeah. That's so cool. Play the notes next to the notes you want to play. Yeah. That's great advice, man. That's a nice memory. Very
thank
cool.
Thank you, Wayne.
Yeah, man.
And then we went to Brazil, and I'd never been to Brazil. I got to hang out in, I guess, was it Sao Paulo and Rio both? The opening group for us was the singer Milton Nascimento.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a great band. And we met all of those guys. And one other thing I remember from that time, so many of the musicians in Brazil they had difficulty finding instruments. And they wanted to buy our instruments. And so I sold, I think, I had some like DX7 modules that I had brought with me. And maybe something else. And anyway, I ended up selling some stuff to some keyboard players that I had met there. And because they really had difficulty accessing instruments.
God, that's got to be torture for a musician, man.
Yeah, it was really, was a real drag. They were, it was really tough. And so this was maybe they, with touring musicians that were going through Brazil, that maybe was something that they did. That was 86, I remember. Yeah.
Phil Upchurch, man, he's such a good guitar player. He played with Donny Hathaway, Ramsey Lewis, solo career. What'd you do with Phil?
Yeah, I did a lot with Phil. He, I think, became familiar with me through Yellow Jackets. And he had a weekly gig at this club in Los Angeles, the Baked Potato.
Sure.
So we played for about a year every Tuesday night. And I also got the opportunity to do a couple recordings with him. I think he made two recordings during that time, and he was looking for tunes. And one of the tunes of mine that he was the first to record and sort of recognize was this tune Revelation that also Robin Ford has recorded and Yellow Jackets have recorded a few times with vocalists and instrumentally. But I played it for Phil thinking it was kind of a throwaway tune. And he said, that's the one. We got to do something with that.
That's
tune.
Cool. So,
yeah, we recorded that with Phil.
Really good guitar player.
He's an incredible guy, incredibly supportive. And then later, after that, this is maybe in the early 2000s, he called me to do this. It was a recording that was a tribute to Curtis Mayfield.
Yeah, he did. He played with Curtis. I know that.
Yeah. And that was an incredible experience too. So he's one of those guys that has always been in my corner. I really have appreciated his support.
That's nice, man. Really cool. That must have been a really cool project. Who else was on that project? Curtis was such a legend, man.
Yeah. So it was the percussionist who had played with Curtis Mayfield. Master something. I'm spacing on his name, but the drummer was Terry Lynn Carrington. Bassist was Bob Hurst. And then Ernie Watts and Wallace Roney was trumpet player. Great players, all of them.
And you know, it's so funny, man. I reached out to Terry Lynn Carrington yesterday to see if she wants to come on my show. This happens all the time. And then when it happens, I know that I did the right thing.
Yeah. She's amazing. I love Terry.
So crazy. Like, what's the random chances of this happening?
Yeah.
Because this happens all the time, and it's so.
Terry Lynn is also one of these kind of people, a connector kind of person. So I met her. I think I met her because I was hired to do arrangements for a Diane Reeves recording that she was producing, and then
that won a Grammy. I think that.
I don't know. I think it was nominated.
Yeah.
It was a recording called That Day. But Terry Lynn asked me to play in her band, so I did a bunch of gigs with her. Then she subbed in Yellow Jackets for a while. And then recently she hired me asked me to play at this fundraiser for Wayne Shorter. And this was a pretty cool band with Herbie Hancock and
it's a pretty cool band.
and Wayne and Esperanza Spalding, Marcus Miller.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
it's like to pick any jazz magazine. That's like all the covers.
Right.
So that's awesome.
That was a great experience, Terry Lynn. Yeah, and
where was that gig?
It was at a home in Beverly Hills, and they were raising money for a documentary on Wayne Shorter called Zero Gravity. And I'm not sure if it's come out or if they're still working on it. That was probably about 3 years ago, but it was the producer of General Hospital or something. Her home is where it took place.
That's wild.
Yeah. And she turned her tennis court into a bandstand, and there were a lot of well-to-do folks.
God bless these wealthy people that love music.
Please. Yeah.
Is this accurate that you played on Rockwell's Somebody's Watching Me?
Yeah.
Tell me about that. I was going through AllMusic, and they always have mistakes. I was like, I wonder if that one's a mistake. I didn't expect to see that, man.
Yeah. There was a friend of mine who was producing some records for Motown. So I think through Ricky Lawson, I met him. And it's been so long, I'm spacing on his name. It's terrible. But he produced El DeBarge, the DeBarge family, and Rockwell. And so he hired me to play on a few of those recordings.
That's so wild.
Yeah, yeah.
That's very cool. Yeah. Marcus Miller.
Yeah, I did a television show with Marcus, and his music was challenging, so we rehearsed for a couple days in prep for that. And then it was just a one-time TV show that I was hired to do. Yeah.
How'd you get connected with who, how did that?
You know, I honestly don't know. I just got a call from, I think, his management company. I really don't know if it was Marcus or if it was word of mouth through someone else we've met and run into Marcus, you know, many times through the years, but that's the only time. Well, at this Wayne fundraiser, and then at this TV show, those are the only times I played with Marcus. Yeah,
very cool. Any other gigs that you did as a sideman that you want to talk about that were, you know, nostalgic or important or just like when, you know, come up in your highlight reel?
Yeah. Well, I spent a year on the road with Joni Mitchell. That was pretty significant. A great band for the guitarists. Michael Landau was the guitarist in that group, and he's one of my very favorite musicians. And Vinnie Colaiuta was playing drums.
Oh my God, what a!
And then Joni's husband at the time, Larry Klein, was the bassist, and we had made a recording earlier, and then it was like a world tour. So
oh wow,
we traveled, you know, Japan, Australia, all through Europe, all through the US for about a year. And it was right after our daughter had been born, and certainly the salary came in really handy, but they also, my wife and daughter also got to take some private jet trips with Joni and the band. And
that's that, so cool.
Yeah.
That's nice. So
that was a really wonderful gig, and I have the utmost respect for Joni Mitchell. She is the real deal, a true artist, was a joy to work with. I really, that was a wonderful time.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Knee-jerk reaction. I know this is a tough question. Top three experiences you've had musically.
Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, we played thousands of gigs with Yellow Jackets and many, many with other people. But I, among the real memorable experiences, I think with Yellow Jackets, two of them took place at the North Sea Jazz Festival in The Hague.
Yeah.
And one was with the Metropole Orchestra. We had a whole set of music arranged by the arranger Vince Mendoza for Yellow Jackets and this orchestra. And we premiered that music at a concert at the North Sea Jazz Festival. And there were probably, I don't know, like maybe 5,000 people in this one of the venues. And it was just a very magical, inspiring, exciting concert. So that would be one. And then I remember another concert at the North Sea Festival in this big hall they had. It was called Staten Hall, and you could pack probably, I don't know, 12 or 15,000 people in there. And the place was jam-packed, and I think we followed James Brown or something.
Oh, my God.
And Sanborn was on right after us, and they would alternate between these two stages. But we just had a really good set, and the people were going nuts. And it was just one of those times where the music, the energy, and the listeners were in sync. And I remember feeling really like high after.
That's so cool, man.
Yeah, that was very memorable. Yeah, those two in particular. And I don't know. There have been a lot of other, you know, really fun gigs. And I think in general, the Jackets love to play clubs and smaller places where you can really feel the audience. They can really feel the music. So some performances in New York, like at the place we've been playing most recently, was Birdland. We've had some incredible experiences there.
That's awesome, man. Dude, I'd love to be in the city and see you guys. That would be so cool.
I mean, every year in fact, right before COVID, we were booked at Birdland. We were waiting to fly out that weekend, and then the word came, the nightclubs, you know, everything's closing down. It was like one year ago, almost to the day. Yeah.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah.
That's crazy. You're also real successful as a teacher. And you've done that a long time. What do you like best about teaching? And like, I've heard people that are serious about teaching say that they learn stuff themselves.
Oh, yeah.
What are some of the more important lessons you've learned from teaching over the years?
Well, I mean, I would say humility. Because you find out right away that you can't, you know, fake it with the students. They can see in just a moment if you're trying to, you know, if you're not speaking from a place of authenticity or knowledge, if you don't admit you know something. And so I always try to be real with the students and acknowledge the stuff that I don't know and just try to share what I do know.
But you're like an extremely authentic. I don't know you, but I would have to say you not being authentic has not been an issue for you throughout your lifetime. I couldn't imagine that. You know,
I try to be real, and I also have certain insecurities around teaching though, because I never really studied in an academic setting myself.
That I understand.
What I know is just come from, you know, what other musicians have shared with me, what I've learned from recordings, what I've learned through my own kind of research and just, you know, on the job experience. So sure. I can share that. And I think there is some value in that, but, there's other areas that, you know, like if someone puts an orchestra score in front of me and says, you know, could you give me a critique on this? I mean, I can't look at it and hear it and recognize what needs, you know, where the problems might be. So,
but that's a specific skill. That's a deep thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're a carpenter and someone says, well, can you build me X kind of a barn, or, you know, that's a real specific thing. You know, that's right.
Yeah, and
it's pretty reasonable.
So that's one of the things.
But that's what happens. I understand where you're coming from, though. When you hold yourself to a high standard in yourself, you expect to want, you know, to be able to do this. When you're that kind of person, and we're all like that, that anybody, you know, you have your own expectations of, well, I should be able to do this, even though it's totally irrational that you shouldn't. I mean, there's no way you could do it, but just because you want to be able to do it and help or whatever. So I get that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally get that.
I think through teaching, it's also made me just realize, I mean, I knew this, but the vastness of music and how I don't think one person could ever really comprehend it all in several lifetimes. I mean, the breadth of styles and, you know, writing and reading and composing, it's so vast. So, just kind of being okay with where you are and trying to share the things that you do know and hoping that will be helpful.
Yeah, man. I think it's great. Low points, Russell. What were some low points or dark periods you've had to deal with in your life, and how'd you get through them?
Yeah. I was afraid you were going to ask that. So disclaimer out front is I've really had, I think, like a charmed life. I have been so fortunate. I've been really lucky. And I mean, starting with my mom and dad being incredible parents and having a stable household and, you know, love and all the rest. So, The low point was just kind of a stupid youthful indiscretion on my part, where I got involved with a friend's girlfriend, and it escalated into a place where this guy was threatening my life and stalking me.
Oh my God!
Yeah. So, and I was really an idiot. I mean, naive and ignorant to have even gotten into that situation.
Now you're a kid with hormones. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. It was my first, like, I'd never really had a serious relationship, and I picked the wrong person to have that first one with. So, so that was kind of a dark period of time, like just a dark cloud hovering at all times for, you know, like a year or so.
Wow.
But fortunately, you know, things subsided and life goes on, and I learned an important lesson, you know, that you have to be respectful and not let, you know, your hormones run away with you. Yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, other than that, I mean, I think the usual up and downs of life, you know, I mentioned to you, I mean, I've lost both my parents and my dad's recent passing. That was really hard. It was with him to his last breath. And, but, you know, those are also growing experiences, you know, when you experience something at a very deep level, and it makes you, you know, think a lot about, you know, what am I doing here, and why am I here, and how should I use the time I have here?
Yeah.
And it's going to come to an end at some point. I mean, so,
I know.
You know, make the most of it and really appreciate. I thought of so many questions I would have liked to have asked my dad. You know, I wish I had.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we had a beautiful relationship, but there's things I would have loved to have known. And recently, my sister sent me down a bunch of photos that were in our family, and I saw all these pictures of all these people that I had the dim recollections of, and I just wish I could have asked my dad, okay, who is this, and what were the circumstances, what was going on when that picture was taken, and what's your relationship with this person? And there's so many things that now will not be answered. I mean, I'll never know.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it's funny you mentioned that, man.
Yeah. You get that family history, yeah.
My younger son, like over the last 6 months, I can tell he's suddenly not concerned, but aware that I have an ex date. You know, he just turned 29. And he's been asking me tons and tons of questions, and I'm happy I feel close with him, and he answers, you know, I'm just happy someone's interested, you know? And it's funny that you say that. So I'm glad he's doing this, because at some point in time that I asked dad all the questions I had, sort of, you know? It's interesting that you mentioned that. Yeah. Cause he's always now. Yeah, I never thought of that. Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that, because now I can keep that in mind. And
I mean, you might even just ask him, you know, are you really curious about this?
I'm open as hell. I'm really open with my kids. I mean, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. I got nothing to hide. Right. I want to hopefully learn something from mistakes. Mostly make mistakes I've made, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm happy to share with them. But it's funny, but I noticed this started once he became preoccupied with.
Does he have a family himself?
He doesn't. He lives on his own, not yet. And man, he's the greatest kid. You know, I want him to get I'll be so happy when he has like some, you know, really cool girlfriend. He's just a very loving human being. He's like that guy, you know. But it's just interesting that all of a sudden these questions, and when you said that, now everything makes sense.
Yeah.
So maybe smarter behind his years, I think. I want to talk about your new record. It's called Inflection. There's two tracks. You have an Inflection A and Inflection D. What is that about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, those are the keys that the tunes are in. And they really, they went a long time without titles. And our drummer, Steve Schaefer, on the recording, he suggested them. Because at the time of recording, one was called In A and one was called In D. Those were the titles. Those were the working titles. And he said, how about Inflection A, Inflection D? Yeah. And this brings up another interesting point. Maybe you can relate to this, or maybe some of your listeners, that on the subject of instrumental songs with titles, you know, and some people, maybe a non-musician, might think that you had this image of this thing and you rushed to your instrument and outpoured this song that, but I mean, that happens rarely for me. And oftentimes the music is written and the title comes after the fact. And you try to be sensitive to the music and the feeling of the song in the title, but it doesn't necessarily mean the title inspired the music. So
yes,
here's a case in point. Yeah,
this is a very common conversation, which is kind of a giggle, like you're smiling. You know, it's just like, how do you name an instrumental song? It's really hard. You know, and I've talked about this with everybody from like Joe Satriani. Everybody has the same thing. It's like, then I or Jimmy was even. I think we talked about it. I think it was Jimmy. They were all. It was like track one, you know, and then they had to go back and change everything and some story. It was, but everybody has the same issue with instrumental music. And
yeah.
You know, like you said, you, as a lay person, you think, oh, inflection. I wonder what he was probably looking at, a puzzle or.
That's
great.
Yeah. And the title, inflection just came about because, you know, during this pandemic and especially in the beginning, I heard a lot of people talking about it's an inflection point, you know, like in terms of people having to really confront issues and change direction, you know, like the pandemic really forced a lot of soul searching and sort of, you know, all the disparities in, you know, care of people, who was getting sick, who was getting help, and all Black Lives Matter and all the stuff swirling around. So it was an inflection point. And then I looked up the word because then I thought of, how about just the word inflection? And I saw that it also could be spelled with an X, but it in the dictionary, it gives the definition of something changing direction, you know, and I thought of this, the trio music in relationship to Yellowjackets music, and I thought it's really more introspective and kind of bending inward, you know, inflecting. It's a change of direction for maybe people that were familiar with the stuff that I've done with Yellowjackets,
some
other thing. So that's where that title came from. And I think you were curious about another title too.
Yeah, man, stick-to-itiveness. And let me tell you why I'm curious. I heard this word one time in my life. I was at a business seminar and a guy got up and he was reading a letter his dad wrote to him. And his dad said to him, good luck in your career or something. He goes, you'll make it as long as you have the stick-to-itiveness you need. And I never forgot that because it was such an odd, it was a very appropriate, but I'd never, you know, you don't hear it like that. And I love the song, great syncopated drums against your piano. Great. I mean, really good. But what, tell me about that stick-to-itiveness, man. Where did that come from? Were you at the same business seminar?
Well, you know, I had heard the word, I forget it, the context, but anyway, to me, you know, the obvious meaning is kind of staying with something, tenacity, like hard work, sort of, you know, all of those characteristics that could make someone suggest grit, sticking with it. But there's a second meaning that I thought about for this tune, because oftentimes percussionists and drummers, but other percussionists, they talk about stickings, and those are the relationship of your left and your right hand, like a paradiddle is like the drum rudiments.
Yeah.
And so that's musically, that's what's happening with the tune stick-to-itiveness. There's a combination of left and right hand, and the left hand fills in every beat that the right hand doesn't play. Do you want me to show you?
Yeah, man. Let's do it.
Okay.
I would love that. I would love that. Oh, wait a minute. One question. You own the publishing here, right? Because if you don't, they're going to pull this off. That's the only reason.
No one's going to pause. Yeah. So So there's no break in the rhythm. Every eighth note is getting played. So whatever my right hand doesn't play, my left hand plays. So. So, if the right hand's going, every beat that's not being played is being filled in with the left hand. So it's like a sticking.
Russell, so, that was so beautiful, man. And you know, when you listen to that on headphones, it was so nice to see you do that, man. Wow.
Oh, cool. Yeah, and that's so
that was so beautiful when I listened to that, and then it was thank you for doing that. That was really that was cool. Oh, thank good. You, man.
Yeah. You know, a lot of musicians I found tend to be like punsters, you know, like bad punny kind of joke. So that's my affliction as well. So things that have double meanings, you know, sticking and then staying with it.
That was so good, man. Thank you so much. Yeah, wow.
My pleasure.
So I went on my long walks and listened to it, and it was so, yeah. And so when you just did that, I was just right outside with the headphones listening to you automatically again.
It's oh, cool.
Thank you, man. That was so great. How did you, what did you do, man? You're like a professional film editor. What the hell? It's like, bam. And next thing I'm in the keyboard. What do you do?
Yeah.
Did you do?
So, you know, for teaching, oftentimes if I need to demonstrate something, I have another little camera that's just above the keyboard next to me. So I'm speaking with you now on, you know, it's the face, just the face time camera, whatever, the computer camera, but I can switch to this.
You just hit a switch and there's another camera.
Yeah,
that's so cool.
Yeah, that's gives the overhead there. Yeah.
Yeah, that was cool. Thank you. That was great. Thanks again for playing it. That was really nice. I wasn't expecting. That was very cool. I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
Spoons, another great song on there. I loved the times. I don't know how you can write like I couldn't actually count the time signature and the tempo changes, but how do you write something like that is beyond me. But it's just like a really fun vibe in that song. It was over 6 minutes long. It was just like a really cool ride, man. I really loved the song, and I was curious, what's the backstory to that song?
Yeah. Well, it's actually a tune that was written quite a while ago, and in fact, the iteration of Yellow Jackets with Ricky Lawson and Mark Russo and Jim Haslip and myself. I think we worked it up first, and we played it on some gigs. It was really fun, but it never seemed like it quite fit any of the Yellow Jackets recordings. So it was kind of, you know, in the background. And then it would maybe resurface every few albums. How about Spoons? What about this?
Did I mention Spoons?
Yeah. And it didn't quite, you know, it never found a home on a Yellow Jackets recording. But the first person to actually, or the only other recording of it, was done by Eric Marienthal.
Oh, okay.
On a recording of his called Crossroads. And Eric and I think John Patitucci was producing that recording, and they both asked me if I had any tunes. They were looking for music, so I contributed three songs to his recording, and one of them being Spoons. And it was with Terry Lynn on drums.
There you go, man.
She comes again.
She's coming up.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
Love that song. Really good.
Oh, cool.
It's a long song. It's hard to...
Yeah.
6 minutes is a lot. It's not easy to write.
Yeah, it's kind of a longer form. Yeah. And it's actually, though, it is all in 4/4, but it's just where the accents happen that maybe give it the the illusion that it's changing meters, but everything is actually
it is 4/4, okay.
But
it's great it's song, man.
Thank you.
Thanks, and thanks for telling me. I'm gonna go back and listen to it because I want to make sure I can follow it better now.
Yeah.
And then you did a beautiful, really melancholy but optimistic arrangement of the song "We Shall Overcome." What prompted you to cover that?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned this, I think, in the abbreviated liner notes that this trio, we actually, one of our first gigs was at this Episcopal church in Pasadena, California, and they have a jazz Vespers series. So maybe once a year we would be booked to play in the church. It was a really cool setting. Totally acoustic, nothing amplified at all. And we often played in January around Martin Luther King Day. So we would work up music that was associated with civil rights movement. And so I made this arrangement of We Shall Overcome. And I grew up, you know, hearing church music, kind of reverent music, and
your dad was a choir director, right?
Yeah, he was a choir director, yeah. And I mean, we were in church like 3 times a week.
You know, wow.
Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. And, you know, I mean, I spent a lot of
time. It's a lot of time in church,
in the pews. But there's something, I'm definitely influenced by that music, you know, hymns and gospel and kind of reverential music. And We Shall Overcome is, I kind of, it's like a hymn to me. I mean,
it's a soulful song, man. If
you can't, it is. Yeah, it has such deep connections for so many people. So,
it's kind of like, it reminds me of almost like another song I feel like that about is Sam Cooke, Change Is Gonna Come.
Oh, yeah.
That's like,
yeah. You know, it's right there.
Yeah, it's sort of similar to that. Just really good stuff.
You know, this is on another topic, but I don't know if you've seen this series on PBS yet. It's called The Black Church.
No.
It is so good. It's it's 4 hours total. There's two-hour episodes, and there's so much about the influence of, you know, the church in to blues, jazz, contemporary music, and tracing the roots and great musicians that have come through the church. So a lot of it is about music, even though the focus is more the history of the church and social issues. But I highly recommend.
Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely check that out. Yeah, because there's so much great music that came through. I mean, I've had, I can't tell you how many, I would say 15 to 20% of all the musicians I've had, 10 to 15% for sure, got their start in church.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And they really got, musically, they took a lot out of it. Learning to work, you know, everything you learn about music, learning to work with others, support, you know, it was a great training ground for all of the people, man.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and also, realizing the power, the emotional power of music, you know, because in church it's very emotionally charged, you know, or can be.
Yeah.
And
well, especially like if in a black church, man. I mean that's it doesn't get any when I was a little kid, I remember saying, man, I'm not a religious person. I ever said, if I ever become religious, I need to join, I remember watching the Blues Brothers, I need to join that church because that looks like they're having fun there, man.
Yeah.
That looks like some serious, like, experiences going on there, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On this subject, very really quickly, one thing they point out in this documentary is that in the North, the black churches were very kind of proper and restrained.
Yeah.
And people, you know, they are, you know, slaves and people and the descendants of slaves found that very oppressive. So in the South, the churches were more reflective of this looser, let's let it fly kind of thing.
Yeah, and let's celebrate our feelings about God or whatever. Right, yeah, right. Yeah.
It wasn't stifled in any way. So it's
interesting.
That's
a good point. I'm going to definitely check that. Thanks for telling me about that.
Yeah.
It's funny. You mentioned something about inflection. It made me think about, you know, about an inflection point. I saw this meme and it had, you know, that sort of, what's it called? The Eye in London. It's like a Ferris wheel.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So apparently there's going to be in 2027, a Ferris wheel type thing taking us to Mars. And it had that like snippet, but then the guy wrote, there goes, hey man, we just want health insurance. You know, like that's great. But you know, for the 18 people that get to do that, it's going to, you know, we could give us all health insurance for that money. You know, it was very, you know, coming on the heels of COVID, it was like a very timely comment, like, you know, priority sort of, right? Unfair question for you. Favorite musicians you've enjoyed playing with?
Oh my goodness.
I'll issue your disclaimer that if he doesn't mention you, it doesn't mean you're not his favorite. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, but I mean, right now I love the musicians I'm playing with in Yellow Jackets, Bob Mincer, Dane Alderson, our bassist, William Kennedy, drums, and the guys in the trio that recording we were just talking about, Steve Schaefer on drums and Michael Valerio on bass, incredible musicians. Some of my other favorite, you know, Robin Ford. I mean, he's responsible for my having any kind of musical career. I am indebted to him forever. He was the pivotal person that really introduced me to the profession, being a professional musician. And he's the first guy who I ever heard where I felt his instrument was not in any way an impediment to him expressing himself. It felt like he had this just channel from his soul through what came out his instrument. And that was so inspiring and still is to this day. I mean, that's the gold standard for any musician. However complex or simple it might be, if it's like direct from your heart to
mine as a listener.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Exactly. That's the connection, man.
So And then as I mentioned before, Wayne Shorter, just for his intellect and his conception of music and being kind of unbounded by, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that. It seemed like the possibilities were endless for him. And then other people, I played with a saxophonist when I lived in San Francisco. His name was Jim Pepper, and he was an American Indian, and he was very connected to his culture and traditions. And we traveled up to Alaska to play these Native American events, and we spent a lot of time in the Pacific Northwest where his family was from. And that was a real transformative experience too. He was a super soulful guy, and just this huge heart, and one of these characters that just drew people to him. People just loved him because I don't know what it was about him, but he loved everyone else. And he had some terrible habits and was, you know, in terms of his personal, his use of alcohol or drugs and all of that. I mean, he had struggles, but none of that got in the way of his heart reaching out. And I loved him and I loved working with him. And he had a really big impact on the way I think about music.
Now, you play with Art Pepper too. They weren't related, were they?
And I played with Art Pepper. Yeah. They're not related. No.
I want to ask you about that. because
yeah,
he's another guy that really struggled.
Oh yeah.
I mean, yeah. You know,
right. He was in prison for a long time and
he had yeah. a book that you wrote. He's got this one song and I probably everybody know it. Patricia, I think, is named after his daughter that apparently went because of all his heroin addiction. He never really raised her, but it's such an amazing song. Mm. What was your experience with him? Because man, what a player, yeah. but it's as so many in that era that got hooked on heroin, you know, yeah. that struggled with it. What was your experience with him? Like, right. what was that like? How'd you get even yeah. hook up with him?
Right. So, okay. So that came, In the early 80s, there was a club out in Malibu, California, called Pasquale's. And they would have jazz, you know, every night of the week. And I played with a lot of different people there and was often called to be in the rhythm section for traveling musicians who came out to play the gigs at Pasquale's. So
like the house, you're part of like the house bands.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And so Art Pepper came for the week and the owner or the manager of the club was a bass player. Pat Senatore was his name. And he would hire me on occasion for various groups. So he hired me that week. And the drummer was famous drummer Billy Higgins, who had played with, you know, Ornette Coleman and all kinds of classic records. So he was on drums and, Art Pepper was the featured artist that week, so that was my experience.
How was it?
It was great. I don't think I fully realized, you know, who I was playing with. I mean, I was, I don't know how, maybe like 25 or 6 or so at the time, and just didn't quite.
Well, you might not have gotten which Art Pepper came either, you know. I mean, you know, because when you have an active drug problem that bad, you don't know who's showing
right.
up.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I don't know, but I remember he. I mean, musically he was great, but I wasn't really in that musical place sure. as passionately as he was. I mean, he was coming from that bebop era and very, you know, and I. It wasn't what I was actively working on.
Sure.
I enjoyed it, but as in some other situations I've been in when I've been younger, I don't think I fully realized.
Yeah.
Where, and, you know, one other, I don't, not to belabor this point, but another experience like that I had was when you mentioned we did this, contributed some music to Star Trek IV, and we worked with the composer, the composer who wrote the rest of the score, his name was Leonard Rosenman, mm-hmm. and he was a famous Hollywood film scorer who he had been roommates with James Dean, and
oh, wow.
he had written a score for Rebel Without a Cause and the TV series Combat, and he had written orchestral music.
Combat, I love that show.
Yeah,
that was really cool.
Yeah, so I again here the Jackets were in the studio with Leonard, and we rearranged one of his pieces from the movie, and I just didn't realize what a heavy guy he was, and we were kind of I think somewhat not dismissive, but we. You know, he was an older guy, was smoking all the time, and it was just, you know, I wish I would have understood yeah. more. And then later on, like this is probably maybe 5 years ago, we went to a performance of the L.A. Phil at Disney Hall in Los Angeles, and they had they were talking about. Leonard Rosenman, I think maybe John Williams was conducting all these film scores and stuff, and was Leonard Rosenman's family was there, and they talked about how he was one of the first film composers to really like get in the music sort of mirrored the psychology of the characters, like he really got into the inner, you know, psychological drama, and he's credited as being the first guy to really tap into that as a film scorer. And they played some of other excerpts of his music, and it was so gorgeous. I mean, I was practically weeping and realizing how ignorant was I at that time, not to really fully realize who we were working with, but I was just clueless, you know?
Well, plus, when you're young, you're not like, as you, I know myself, as I've gotten older, I've gravitated more towards older people because they got something I don't, which is knowledge and wisdom, right? So I want to hear that when I can. But when I was a kid, I was like, like you said, dismissive. It was hey man, we're happening.
This is
my shit, you know?
That's right.
It's just like that's this attitude you have when you're younger, you know, with rare exception, you know?
Right, so,
That's good, man. Thanks. That was a good, thanks for sharing. Yeah. What's the last thing you listen to for pleasure on your iPod or wherever you listen to music?
Well, this was partly for pleasure and partly for school, because every week with a couple of classes, we have these listening assignments, and a lot of times I encourage the students to suggest them. So the last thing we were listening to was a recording. It was Louis Armstrong and Oscar Peterson. They did one record together, and it's really beautiful. And
what's that record called? I didn't know
You know, I think it's just called, you know, Louis meets Oscar, or Oscar meets Louis. I forget. But it's the only one where it's Oscar Peterson. Actually, it's a quartet because there's guitar. And by the way, the guitar playing on this recording is just so perfect. It's the guitarist Herb Ellis, who played a lot with Oscar Peterson, and the two of them are so in sync. It's really it's just inspiring to hear that, because sometimes piano and guitar can be a train wreck.
It's hard to make that work.
These guys are they're like hand in glove. So that's the last thing I heard. And it's, you know, just standards. And Louis Armstrong is mostly singing. He plays some trumpet. But it's a beautiful recording. The artistry of each individual. Louis Belson was the drummer. The bassist was Ray Brown. And Herb Ellis.
Thanks. I'm going to check that out. Oscar meets Louis.
Yeah.
Give me your top three desert island discs, just for minute, not for, you know.
Yeah. Well, probably, I mean, maybe this be somewhat surprising, but there's this double CD I have with Joe Beam and Frank Sinatra with Klaus Ogerman arrangements and Diodato arrangements. And it's beautiful. It's like orchestra and all these great Brazilian standards, a couple American standards. I love that recording. I love the arranger, Klaus Ogerman. He's, I think, my favorite orchestral arranger. He's arranged for Bill Evans and Michael Brecker and all kinds of people. And then it would have to be something from John Coltrane, because he's my favorite jazz musician, most inspiring jazz musician. So Love Supreme, I love that.
Can't record. Go wrong with that, man.
Yeah, right. That's probably on a lot of people's desert island list. And then maybe, you know, like Heavy Weather. I think that was a recording that had a lot of impact on when I first heard it. It was so fresh and exciting, and hear Jaco Pastorius for the first time. Yeah, so
that comes up a lot, that record.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Tell me the best decision you ever made.
Yeah, I think it's the same one that you mentioned in your information.
Marry my wife.
Yeah. You know. But you made me think of this, Craig.
What's that?
That decisions are important, but what might be as or more important is what you do after you make a decision. Because, you know, you could decide you know, like in our case, we married our wives. But would you say there were moments when your relationship was challenging and maybe you might have thought, you know, I'm not sure this is totally working? And had you acted upon that best decision you ever made, you might look back on as the worst decision you'd ever made, you know, if you ended up in some messy divorce. And so that the point being, you know,
yeah, decisions aren't stagnant.
No, and they're dependent on what you do. And even something that might, like I quit school, you know, I don't think that was the greatest decision, but I tried to make the most of what came after that. So,
and you did.
Well, I tried. Yeah, I'm trying. Yeah, yeah.
You did. So, yeah. Well, I mean, if you'd have, you know, gone on tour with Jimmy Witherspoon and then, like, you know, took a job in a factory, you know, that.
Yeah, and it had a dead end gig. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Right.
So, but yeah, I think a lot of it is interest, especially with relationships. I mean, if anybody gets married and you think, you have to, somebody told me this and I was really happy they told me this early on in my marriage. They said, you know, a marriage is like a business. If you stop working it, it stops working. And I didn't know that because I didn't come from a good, that background. So I was so happy he told me that because I always, and then I was fortunate to marry a woman who somehow knew that. And she, we always, you know, working was not a working to keep, you know, we're always both like, man, this is overall pretty cool. We need to put some effort into it. You know, the return, it was never an issue for us. Thank goodness. It was also my second marriage. So I knew what I didn't want. I was married really young. So, it was always like, hey, let's, and then now, of course, as you get older, it's like almost immediate, you know, we never, like, why waste time arguing at this point? Like, you know, like that's the dumbest thing. Okay, let's get this worked out. You know, there's no ego anymore. It's like, you know, hey, I'm sorry. You know, I was an asshole. Let's move on. You know, I shouldn't have said, or, you know, whatever. It's just like, that's the last thing you want to do at this age, right? It's like, let's.
That's
like,
right. And I find I'm most of the time, I'm the one, I wouldn't say crawling back, but definitely acknowledging that.
But that's great though, man. And it's like,
I could.
Yeah, but that's an act of love.
Yeah.
You're not doing it because you're like, you're a schoolboy, like, oh, I don't want to get punished. It's like, you know, hey, I screwed up. I love you. I'm sorry. Let's, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Face up to it. Yeah.
It's great, man. You know, it's just like some, I think to me, it makes the relationship like better.
Yes.
You know, when you can sort of like, you know, it's like you're more vulnerable and you're more considerate. You know, I don't know. I think so. So works. It's working. So I'm not, you know, I find finally found something that works. And believe me, I'm not questioning it.
Yeah.
Tell me what makes you happy.
Oh, well, a lot of things. I mean, when I'm with all of my family, like we have one daughter and we have a granddaughter, and when we're all together, that's like, that's really something special. And with our pets too, at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you have? Dogs, cats, both?
Oh, we have three little dogs. Three,
that's cool.
Like, yeah. And you were talking about walking. So every morning I'm out with them.
With your three dogs. Cool.
Whether I want to be or not, they're demanded. Yeah. Playing music makes me happy. I love doing that. And the other thing that kind of a daily activity of mine is cycling.
Oh,
and I'll go out every morning and I have like a little 10-mile loop that I do. We live in the foothills outside of Los Angeles. So got some hills and has some challenging terrain, but it's so meditative and just feels great to be outside and kind of checking out, you know, the sky and the,
and that keeps you so, I mean, that is the best medicine in the world to me.
Yes.
And from everything I read, you know, exercises, you know, consistency and you just feel, and you can see it, man, because you'll look on Facebook or whatever and you see the people you went to high school or you know, whatever. And I know me, I'm always going to my wife, do I look this bad? And this is not because I'm not bad. It's just I've taken care of myself a little better, you know, more often than not, you know?
Right. Yeah.
All right, tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
Oh, man. Well, I was talking to my wife about this actually yesterday, and I'll tell you what she mentioned.
What does she like most about you?
She said that I'm really adaptable, and that could be good and bad, because the bad side is that if stuff's not working, or something needs attention, I can just deal with it, and I might not get on it to get it fixed. But on the other hand, when you're in situations where other people might get really wound up about things, I can generally, I'm okay with it. I can make things work. So
you seem pretty, I would think people don't get upset with you often. And I would also think you don't get upset with others often. You seem very amiable, man.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah. I think occasionally, but very on rare occasion.
Yeah, like I would imagine you'd really have to be pushed to sort of let loose.
I would say so, yeah. Yeah, so that might be, I think that is probably a positive.
Yeah, quality. Totally, man. Tell me your best childhood memory.
Oh, well, I remember, in the neighborhood we grew up, my best friend lived across the street.
This is San Jose, you said?
Yeah, okay. In San Jose. And we were both into sports, and we were always, had some game going every day. And we had one challenging period during my childhood where my mom was actually in the hospital for about 6 months.
Wow.
And so we'd get back from school, and my dad was at work, but the family of my best friend would kind of keep an eye on my sister and I. And so my friend Steve and I would hang hard doing all this stuff. And then my dad get off work, he'd bring us to our grandmother's. We were sleeping there, but then coming back to go to school. And so I really connected with this family and my friend Steve. And those were really wonderful. I just loved hanging on that block kind of with all these characters. There were a few other people, notable characters that we would hang with.
And that's good.
Yeah.
Good. Nice. Really, you had a positive thing going on in that potential crisis. That's great.
Yes.
Man.
Yeah.
You have any hobbies outside of music?
I mentioned cycling. That's a constant thing.
You're a reader, I bet, right?
I do read. Yeah. I read a fair amount. Yeah. I love sports. And when I was in school, before I was into music, I was into sports. And, I guess this, not to be bragging, but I got a couple college scholarships to play basketball. And
awesome.
Ended up playing for a year at San Jose State, and that where I started school, and then I got into music and dropped out the next year.
What did you play?
I was a guard.
Yeah. Wow. Are you tall?
No, I'm not that tall. In those days,
that must this be pretty. You got to be a good ball player if you're getting a scholarship to play basketball and you're not particularly tall.
I mean, I was really into it. That's where before I was into music, I was into to sports. I mean, I don't. I only cycle now. I mean, rarely. Occasionally, there'll be a hoop somewhere in a basketball, and I might shoot a few hoops. Yeah, I love that. And then just family stuff, just hanging. That's mostly now, if I have any free time, I'm going to spend it with my wife, or my daughter and her daughter live out in Boston. So
haven't
been able to see them for about a year.
So God, that's got to be awful, man.
Yeah, it is. We're really missing them. So we're planning a trip
Yeah, I was very grateful that all my kids are here. In fact, we didn't see them for a few weeks, but when they came over, it was just good to hug them. You know, I was just so happy. You know?
Yeah.
I hope you get to see her soon. That's great.
Thank you.
Yeah. And you can feel sorry for me because I'm a Knicks fan. So
I loved it. I remember I was really following basketball hard during the Patrick Ewing.
That was such a fun, exciting Monroe.
Yeah, DeBuscher. They had a great team. I was into the Knicks. They're a great team.
Yeah, well, it's been a long time ago.
Yeah.
Favorite place you've traveled? I know you've been all over the world.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of them, but because of my heritage, I would say Italy is maybe my favorite place to go.
Awesome.
The food is so off the charts and people are so passionate and great, love life. And then maybe in second spot, I love the Scandinavian countries as well, like Stockholm, Copenhagen. Those are just fantastic cities. Everyone speaks English, which is helpful. Yeah, and beautiful place. Yeah.
Good, a lot of fresh fish and food there, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
I understand. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
All right, two more questions. And I just want to say thank you so much. You've been so nice to talk to and so cool. Oh, so thanks. It was a pleasure and a privilege.
My pleasure.
Toughest decision you had to make or most difficult thing you've had to do?
I don't think I've faced any like life kind of changing decisions that I've really had to, ponder and stress over. In terms of a decision, like I mentioned before, maybe I'm just more going with the flow and adapting to whatever the situation is in front of me. But the most difficult experience I had was just being, I mentioned my father dying.
Sure.
And I was his primary caregiver for the last month and a half of his life. So, that was profound, but also difficult. And but I'm so glad I was there, able to be there with him. It was, and maybe there's, I'm sure other people can totally understand that there's the pain, but there's also just you really learn and you feel deeply.
But you weren't alone, and he wasn't alone. No, that's what.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
That's the beauty of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you. And the last question, what's been the biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years? And how much of that change has been intentional and how much has just been a natural part of aging?
Yeah, I think probably just realizing that, I'm not going to have an enormous transformation at this point in my life. I'm basically the person that I
final product.
I am, not to say that there's not, I'm going to still keep trying to learn more and be more and come to greater understanding about life and everything else. But I'm okay with who I am right now. And also, the gratitude element, I've really realized how fortunate I have been and appreciating that a lot more. Not taking it for granted like maybe I did at earlier points. So that's probably, kind of accepting yourself,
Thank you, man. I think everybody that's, gets to the baby boomer age, that's a really common thing. Finally, just I'm comfortable in my own skin, or I don't care. I care less what other people think of me.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's so liberating, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Let me tell people, I would love everybody to check out your new record, Inflection. Thank you again for everything. Let me tell people where to find you. Okay, so Russell's new record is called Inflection. It's his trio. It's a great record. It's got some really beautiful stuff. It's an hour and 12 minutes, man. It's got some bunch of originals.
Did we overstay our welcome?
No, it's awesome. It's so refreshing. I'm like, holy shit, who puts out a record an hour and 12? I was like, this guy kicked ass, man. That's like not, you know, most people are making EPs now. You know that. I thought it was like a yeoman effort. Buy the record at russellferrante.com, RussellFerrante. And Russell is such a class act. When you buy it, he will sign it and send you a personal thank you note. And that's not something that he does that not because he wants to sell copies. That's just who the guy is. He's a good human being. Also, if you want to get anything from the Yellow Jackets, go to yellowjackets.com. The album is, and I'm not joking, charging up the charts on the jazz chart. So, you know, check it out at a minimum. Few other things. You can find Russell is available for tracks if you're interested in working with him or production. A couple of things there. You can contact him on his website at russellferrante.com. Again, Ferrante. There's a contact form there, and you can also find him on Facebook and message him there. Just obviously, if you're interested in working with him in either of those capacities, give him some links, let him know what you're thinking, you know, have a conversation with the guy so he could at least know how to respond to you and check out your music and see if it's a fit, and he'll get back to you. Russell, this was something that I would encourage everybody to pay close attention to. Russell teaches full time at USC. He does occasionally take on some students for lessons. If you're interested in working with him, you know, it's probably not like weekly lessons, but if you have some specific trouble spots or you want to learn something new, or you've listened to something he does and you'd like to get some insight from help from the horse's mouth, how he does it, reach out to him. He is available. Again, the more information you can provide, I mean, you don't got to write like an Encyclopedia Britannica entry, but just give him some information as to what you're looking for so he can get back to you and let you know if he could help you or not. And same thing, go to russellferrante.com, the contact form, or message him on Facebook. And that's it. Is there anything else I could sell? You had Russell Ferrante t-shirts?
No apparel.
You need a Russell Ferrante bobblehead for the front panel of the car. Hey, man, thank you very much for everything. It's really been nice talking to you and getting to know you. And thanks for being such a cool guy. And everybody, check out Inflection. It's a beautiful record. It's really good, man. And thanks for playing it. That was a real treat. I didn't expect that.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. Enjoyed it.
You're welcome. Likewise. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Thanks very much to Russell Ferrante for everything. Again, check out the album Inflection at russellferrante.com. If you're interested in working with him with tracks or production or lessons, same thing, go to his website and message him and just give him some information. And most important, especially nowadays, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your piano, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Russell, thank you for everything, brother.
Thanks, Craig.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.